All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. If you're new here, just hang out. You'll get the hang of it. Blues freaks, this is your day, maybe. Buddy Guy is on the show today. Yeah, I talked to Buddy Guy. And I'll talk to you about talking to Buddy Guy and why it was important to me to talk to Buddy Guy and the blues in general. Maybe some other stuff. But before I get into anything, I should tell you that this show was pre-recorded more than usual. Longer back than usual. I'm recording this, it doesn't matter the day, but it's a few days ago from when you're listening to this. And the only reason I say that is because a couple of reasons. Well, it had to be done because my producer, Brendan, is going to be on vacation this week, and I have a few days off this week, and we decided why not to be free of this for a week. I'm not going anywhere. I was just in Texas. And again, I want to thank the people of Dallas, Houston, and Austin, Texas, for really being tremendous audiences, and all the people that worked at the venues. The venues were great. The Paramount in Austin, the Majestic in Dallas, and I think it's the Cullen over at the Wortham Center in Houston. Really, I mean, it was just like a perfect few days. Really was. So hopefully, here's why I tell you that this is recorded a few days in advance. Because if something major happens in the world that might require me addressing it, it will not be heard about here because this was recorded before it happened. So hopefully nothing horrible has happened. On the outside chance, something amazing happened. I'm very excited about it, even though I don't know what it is. Also, what I'm hoping for is that with this week I got at home to reassess, to reconfigure, to recontextualize, to reclaim my being. Hopefully, when you hear from me Monday, I will have gotten off nicotine lozenges. Why? Why are you asking? Why are you asking why, Mark? Why, Mark? Why would you get off them? I guess to some of you would think, like, why? Of course you should get off them. It can't be good. That's a good reason. I'm just saturated. I am a nicotine sponge. I just, the arc of having the compulsion to do things that feel good without stopping has gotten me into a sort of a steady, slightly nauseous state. And I went to have a physical. Physical was okay. Some things were okay. Some things were, I'm not sure what that is. So I figure, why not clear this, just clean the slate. Let's get down to ground zero of Mark's biology. Can we do that? I don't know what that entails, really. Obviously, I have to eat, but I'm going to eat clean. I'm thinking about maybe no protein powders. I'm thinking about maybe no caffeine. Definitely no nicotine and just, you know, basic shit, clean, not many carbs. It might be boring to you, but I gotta see what's up. I'm just curious. Cause you know, you spend all this time being healthy and then it's sort of like, I feel like I should be healthier than that on the page. And then you realize I'm getting old. How much longer do I have? And what am I really aspiring to? I don't know. But hopefully when you come back here or after the weekend, I will have gotten off of them. I can't guarantee it. See, I'm already, you know, I'm supposed to be off them tomorrow and I'm already like finding that space. I don't know, maybe tomorrow. Tomorrow I'll kick. Buddy Guy's here. Buddy Guy. Look, man. Yeah, the world is burning, and sometimes it's hard to know what to do. And I don't know if the blues make you feel better. I don't know what they do, but they sort of, either you've got the heart for them or you don't. Blues music. Now, I got to be honest with you. I don't listen to a lot of new blues. I don't listen to a lot of, I don't listen to a lot of blues made after maybe, I don't know. There's a few guitar players I've listened to, but not compulsively like I listened to some of the old guys. And I don't know why. I don't know why I've got the heart for it. I love to play blues guitar. I love it. It makes me feel better than almost anything. I should do it more. I love it more than I like listening to blues music, to be honest with you, at this point in my life. Because to get into the real blues, into the deep blues, before the sort of like, what would you call them? The noodling appropriators, you know, to get into the earlier evolution of them, you know, a couple, maybe a generation from removed or a generation past the source point of Africa, generation or two, you know, to really get that groove. But I got hip to it when I was a little kid for some reason. You know, I was played that music by a guitar teacher. I had that Robert Johnson record, the crackly one. But there was a couple of people like Muddy Waters, you know, specifically. And, you know, another way in, oddly, was some of the early Stones stuff. And then I got hip to some Chess recordings, Sonny Boy Williamson, J.B. Lenore. You know, I had some Lightning records. I had the Muddy records. I had Mississippi John Hurt record when I was a kid. And, you know, and it just never went away, my hunger for hearing some of the older guys, you know, like Skip James, you know, his sound, the way he played those notes. Everyone played those notes so different. And so many of them were the same notes. It didn't fascinate me. It moved me. You know, the falsetto blues sound of Robert Johnson or Skip, you know, just like it kind of just went in and it moves me. It taps me into some sort of universal frequency that is elevating. It's both melancholic and celebratory. And then like I, you know, as I got older, you know, I listened to, I was in high school, I was real into Stevie Ray's brother, Jimmy, and the Fabulous Thunderbirds. And I got into that fast moving shit, that Texas jump blues. Did a little Johnny Winter at certain points, early Eric Clapton. Yeah, and this is all always unfolding. When I was in college, I saw Big Mama Thornton towards the end of her life. I saw Willie Dixon towards the end of his life. I saw John Hammond Jr. at the Tucson Blues Society with about 40 other people completely channel Robert Johnson into Hellhounds on My Trail, and it just blew me away. Then I got into other people doing those Johnson songs, like the Stones, like Love in Vain, even the Gun Club with Preaching the Blues. I just kind of tracked it. I don't really love bar blues. I liked Canned Heat. That guy, I think his name's Dave Wilson, was a real channeler. There were certain channels. You know, some of the white dudes that dug that shit and got into it and found their own voice in it. I was moved by them. Buddy Guy's early stuff. To hear Buddy Guy kind of, you know, find a place on his guitar that no one had found before. You know, there's a lot of cats that found it. Albert King, Freddie King, B.B. King, John Lee Hooker, Lightning Hopkins. Get into that groove. Listen to that fucking Hooker and Heat album. Canned Heat and John Lee Hooker. That's some crazy shit. Yeah, that's where it meets up. Listen to those Peter Green records. Peter Green, that Chicago record that he did with Fleetwood Mac back in Otis Spann and a couple other cats. I don't know. Paul Butterfield's first record. What am I going to just list records? But there was a Chicago thing, Muddy. Muddy and Wolf. Get those Wolf records. Fuck, man. But Buddy Guy always had a sound that you could identify. You know, I could hear it when he was playing backup with other people. Just the way he handled it. Got that Stratocaster going. I pulled mine out after I talked to Buddy. Albert Collins, another guy. Not Telecaster, man. Searing. I'm not going to sit here and list them. It's just, if the shit goes into you and moves you, you got the thing. And this conversation might be fun for some of you if you have the thing. I didn't know where it was going to go, and Buddy's been talking a long time, and he's been around a long time, but there's a couple of nuggets in this conversation about certain people, little moments with B.B. King, John Lee Hooker, Earl Hooker, the slide guitar player who I didn't know about, that were really exciting for me. It was exciting for me to meet him. And I saw him at the Hollywood Bowl the night that I talked to him with Charlie Musselwhite, who I've talked to in here, real deal. Jimmy Vaughn and his band and Buddy. And they got to play. They got to play. They can't stop playing. Buddy's 83 years old. And he can still fucking, he's got a thing, man. It's a weirdest thing, you know, when you play guitar, but it's not a matter of being able to do anything fast or being able to do it like anybody else. You know, you got these licks, you're going to make them your own, you're going to, you know, stack them, you're going to turn them inside out. But Buddy, like, just owned them. These are the same notes, a lot of them. But how are you going to bend them? How are you going to pull them? How are you going to let him sustain and sing? I don't know, man. There's a lot of personality to a lot of the great players. And yeah, Hubert Sumlin, who played for Wolf. But anyway, it was a great privilege to talk to Buddy, and I'm glad he came by because the music does speak to me, and I like to play it, and I like to hear stories about the old days. So this is me talking to Buddy Guy. He's currently on tour around the country, and you can see all his tour dates at buddyguy.net. His most recent album is The Blues Is Alive and Well, one of many, many records. And he's 83, man, and he just jumped up these stairs and sat down, and we started talking. I kind of felt bad because, you know, I do comedy and stuff myself. Mm-hmm. And after shows, people come up to me and they want to get their pictures taken.
Oh, tell me about it.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is I've never done it to anybody before. And I was on a plane with you and you wouldn't have known. And, you know, I saw you and I'm like, yeah, he's on my plane. I saw you taking off. And one of your guys, actually, I think knows my show. I don't remember which guy, but he gave me a polka dot pick. But, I get off the plane, I'm at baggage claim. I say, if I don't go get a picture with that guy, I'm gonna be mad at myself.
Well, that would have been easy because that was my guitar tech, because he's the one got the picks.
Yeah. But I ran up to you, you know, and I said, I said what everyone says. Hey, man, I don't usually do this. You know, I don't want to be an asshole, but...
No, I don't. You know. I don't got used to that now, and it made it even. You know, you said to have just a camera. Now, everybody who got a phone got a camera in it. You know, and I tell people, and I have people laughing. I say every time I see somebody with a cell phone, I just say cheese.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's that moment where you do it after shows, and and you're tired, and maybe you're not looking like I always say that there's about 100 people that got pictures of me looking tired with them.
Oh man, I know. You know, I can give you a funny one. A lady came into my club in Chicago, and I took about 100 and something, and I had my son standing beside me, and I made him print out a piece of paper on it, say no more photographs. Mm-hmm. And she came up, she said, I'm from Australia, will you please take a picture with me? I say, well, okay. And I let her take it. And she went away, and about 20 minutes later, she came back. She said, could I please have another one? I said, if you only tell me what happened to the first one. She said, well, it made me look too fat. I said, what you think the camera saw?
That was it. You didn't do another one? You did.
Yeah, I did it for all, man. You know, cause they got their way of figuring out how to get around whatever you're trying to get out of, you know.
Oh, yeah, they come back, or they don't know how to use the phone, or it takes
no,
5 minutes.
No, I know. Sometimes it takes longer than
and you're just standing there waiting, holding a stranger.
Sure.
So, wait, where are you playing? You playing tonight?
No, tomorrow night.
Where at?
At the Hollywood Bowl.
Oh, man, that's exciting.
Yeah, you know, finally, you know, better late than never. You know,
First time?
No. I've been, you know, I guess if you can, on promoters, if you can, I guess, break even, let them make a little something, they'll call you back again. Because I passed there many times in my earlier, younger days with the late Junior Wells, and I'd look at it and say, I'll never make it there, you know? And all of a sudden, you go to sleep, you wake up, and you got 8 Grammys. I've been there before. I made the 8 Grammys, and they invited me back, because I remember once I was there with Bill Cosby, And I don't forgot who was on the show with me. He said, "Man, you know, you got the follow buddy guy."
Good luck.
No, I don't look at it like that. I look at it like that. We're all entertainers, and we just, you know, we've been. I try to be friends with everybody, not just entertainers.
Yeah.
And it's fun to me to be on the show with some other people because I didn't learn how to play my guitar or sing by the book. I learned it by listening to those guys who should have got more recognition than I got, and they didn't live long enough to get it, like the Muddy Waters, the Howlin' Wolves. I could go on till next week.
I saw you. I actually saw you do the second show at a place in Cambridge, Massachusetts, maybe early 80s with Junior.
It was
crazy, you know, because I remember there was one part of your show where you could play like other people.
I still do that.
You do, yeah. You want to hear Jimi Hendrix, and you just do it. Yeah.
Well, you know, the way music is now, it's and thanks for having me, by the way. A lot of radio stations just don't play the type of blues that is the father of most music we have today. And we used to talk about that before Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, the late B.B. King was always said, "Hey, man, if you outlive me, please don't let the blues die." Because that once was a music they call R&B. We didn't have all the names we have now, you know, like a soul and rock and roll and all that stuff. Everything in the earlier days with the Louis Jordan, the early Ray Charles, it was just R&B.
Yeah.
You know, and now, I don't know what it is, you know, they got us separated so much now until you say, you come up and some of the British guys, my best friends.
Yeah.
And they would say, "We're playing the same thing, you know, you all play." My youngest daughter's in the hip-hop. She came to me one day and said, "Daddy, we're just playing y'all music. We're doing it a different way."
Same groove. Yeah. I was listening. I kind of, you know, went through all my stuff, the records I have of yours, and I was listening to later because I was so happy when I got an original copy of Hoodoo Man Blues.
Oh, man. Yeah. Man Junior. Yeah.
Yeah. And I got that one. And then I had one called Walking in the Woods, but that was a compilation.
Walking through the Woods. That's some of my first stuff when I went into Chicago.
Yeah.
A great pianist player named Little Brother Montgomery.
Yeah.
Him and the late Willie Dixon. They gave me that as soon as I got a chance to come into Chess Records.
Where'd you start?
I was born in Louisiana on a farm. I tell people each night from the stage, you know, I didn't know what running water was until I was about 17 years old.
Really?
Yeah, my parents were sharecroppers, and I look at people right now, and when I say that from the stage, I can get a standing ovation. I say, you know, if I went home in the evening when I was 10, 11 years old, I couldn't tell my mom and dad to go get me a piece of Kentucky Fried Chicken, or I'd have to go catch the chicken. And my mom would have to cook that chicken, man, you know. Oh, yeah.
Well, how old were you when you started playing the guitar?
Well, my dad finally, you know, they wasn't able to pay for a guitar. Yeah. An average acoustic guitar back then was $298 or $398, not hundreds.
Yeah.
And they had a guy they used to go get every Christmas, and he would come through the house, and they would have go from house to house and drink the gallon of wine and a quart of beer and no more until next Christmas. And he had a guitar, and the rest of the kids would go and have toys if they could afford to get one.
Yeah.
But I would go pick his guitar.
Yeah.
And my dad finally, he was a cross-cut saw, if you know what that is. Albert King made a record by that, and he finally bought this guitar for $2.
You remember what kind it was or what it was?
It was just a little acoustic guitar with a round hole in it. I don't even know if the name of it.
Nylon strings?
No, it had the regular strings on it, but after I broke as a matter of fact, it had about three strings on it when he got it.
Yeah.
And then I had to take my mom's, hairpins and things like that and splash it because I couldn't afford to buy other guitar strings.
So did you have music in the family? What were you listening to?
Well, back then it wasn't before B.B. King and T-Bone and them, Arthur Crudup and all them. It was all gospel.
Yeah.
It was voices.
So you know? See it once a week or you go here?
No, you couldn't see nothing. Yeah.
But I mean at the church or anywhere?
It was the church, but we didn't have no instruments in the church. It was all voices.
Yeah.
You know, and finally when the five blind boys and the Pilgrim Travelers and people like that and the random record shop started coming out when we finally got that old battery radio where if it rained and cloudy, you couldn't hear nothing nowhere. Once in a while, you'd and then you could hear Lou Rawls or somebody singing the Five Blind Boys.
Yeah.
And then you would try to get the guitar to back you up with that voice is what you heard. And then out pops B.B. King and T-Bone them and then say, oh, man, you know, you got something now. And when they amplified the guitar, that was it.
T-Bone, it's like it's all T-Bone, isn't it?
Yes. Because, B.B. just made his little, they asked him questions about who he was listening to. And I was listening to mostly him.
To B.B.?
Well, I got a chance to hear Arthur Kruder, him, Lightning Hopkins, and people like that, because Lightning was there, you know, playing mostly acoustic stuff himself before B.B. and Les Paul amplified the guitars, because the guitar and a harmonica was obsolete before Little Walter made Juke with Muddy and with the Chess record. You go in the music store and say, how much is the harmonica? He said, I don't know, man. Just give me anything to get it out the way, man.
Until they amplified it, right? In Chicago. Did you play on Juke?
No. I was still picking cotton when Juke came.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Because when I listen to T-Bone Walker, it's like, you know, all the licks are kind of in there, right? It's like the Bible of licks.
Oh, yeah. Because B.B. would talk about it just years before he passed away. He'd say, with Jack O'Lanehart or somebody like that. And then he said, when I heard this guy, T-Bone Walker, he said, just turn him around.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so they were a little older than you, so you're still listening. So by the time they electrified it and Chess was putting out records, you were still in Louisiana.
Still plowing the mule and picking cotton.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And then when did you start taking it seriously? I mean, when did you get your electric guitar?
A stranger bought me my first real acoustic, and it wasn't electric, but you could go by what they call a pickup.
Right.
And you could stick it on there yourself. So that was my first electric guitar I had. And then the first Stratocaster, a guy found out I could play a little, which had Guitar Slim had came out then with things I used to do. And I learned how to play a little Jimmy Reed and stuff like that. And he said, well, you know, if you play in my band, I'll let you play my Strat.
Yeah.
So I played that until I got able to go into Baton Rouge and work at a service station. Then I finally bought a Les Paul Gibson.
So Les Paul was the first one?
That I bought.
That you bought.
Uh-huh.
But then you went back to Strats.
After I got to Chicago, they ripped me off for the Les Paul. And a lady had a club, and she had found out I could play pretty well. And she let me borrow the money if I would play at her place. That was my first Strat.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So you pretty much go between Strats and these, like 335s?
I don't think I ever had a 335, but I know Gibson was offering me all those type of guitars. Because, I look at all guitars by the same. What made me fall in love with the Strat, I first saw Guitar Slim, and I didn't know what the hell that was.
Yeah.
And I found out you could drop it and just scratch it, but you could drop one of the hollow bodies, acoustic, even if it rained on it, it would swell up and break. And I said, this is a solid piece of wood. Yeah.
Right.
This is what I want. It can go, because Slim was wild and crazy.
Yeah.
I made this comment on several interviews I had that I wanted to play like B.B. King, but I wanted to act like Guitar Slim.
What, with the theatrics playing it with your teeth?
Got
that from Slim?
Slim didn't play with his teeth. He was just wired with it. I came up with some of these ideas that I better do something because I didn't ever think I was good enough to play as well as B.B. or T-Bone or Slim. So I said, I got to put a little something else in there and make somebody pay attention to me.
It's funny you say that about the Strat because that's true. When I just read this book about the creation of the solid body.
Solid body, yeah.
And Leo Fender, I mean, those the first Tellys and the first Strats, they were built to take a beating.
To take a beating,
And they were built so anybody could fix them.
Right.
And it took years for Gibson to not be so arrogant because they didn't want to get into the electric guitar business because they thought they were pretty highfalutin. They had the best guitar, so they didn't know how to keep the quality that they would with their acoustic instruments with the electric. And that's always why I always felt, didn't you always feel like Gibsons were kind of the fancy guitar?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
I think a lot
of people like that. Yeah. Did you know that also, not changing the conversation, when I first went to England, it was 1965 before most of those guys got so big and famous. Do you know, from Jeff Beck to Eric Clapton to Jimmy Page, they all came to me and say, I didn't know Strat could play blues. Yeah. And I got this in black and white where they said it. You know, I'm like saying, what do you mean, man? He said, I thought that was a country and western guitar, man, and you couldn't play blues. But now we saw you, we all got Strats.
So you're working at a filling station. You're playing some gigs in Baton Rouge.
Right.
And then what makes you decide to go to Chicago? Because you knew all those guys were there?
Well, you know, you could see the Lewis Jordan, the Ray Charles, but until you got 21, you couldn't see them until they come play in one of those places that they didn't sell booze.
Right.
And I found out if you go to Chicago before you got 21 years old, you wasn't going to be able to get in the club to see them, no way.
Yeah.
So as soon as I turned 21, which was July the 30th, 1957, September that year in 57, I headed to Chicago not to be a guitar player, because I think I was saying, you got a lot to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So someone told me, if you go to Chicago, now you can watch the Muddies, the Wolves, the Walters, and the Sonny Boys and all those people, and maybe you learn some. And all of a sudden, I got stranded, and somebody found out I could play a few licks of Jimmy Reed and the guys who was playing behind Muddy and all those people like that. And then they said, you got to hear this youngster. He can play a little bit like this, that, but he's wild and crazy. And all the guitar players started coming to me, the late Wayne Bennett, Matt Murphy. And I'm like saying, what am I doing to make y'all want to listen to me? And I'm trying to find out what you all doing. I said, man, you kind of wild and people like that, you know, because I would jump off the bar. Wasn't no big blues clubs. And I would just be walking down the bar, and everybody, most of the blues players back then, was sitting in chairs.
Mm.
And
oh,
I said,
really?
Oh, yeah.
The electric guitars.
Uh-huh. And Mud and all of them were sitting in chairs and playing. I said, well, I can get some attention because I'm going to jump around on the stage, which I had saw Guitar Slim do that. Plus, I went there with you got the wireless now. They had a guitar, I saw Guitar Slim with this 100-foot lead wire from the guitar.
Yeah.
And the first time I saw him, they said, ladies and gentlemen, Guitar Slam. And all I saw, I met him right at the stage. And I didn't see no guitar player, but I heard.
Yeah.
And he was coming in the door.
He had a 100-foot wire?
Yeah. Coming in the door with a red suit on, with a white hat. And I said, my God, what is that?
That's what I'm going to do.
That's what I'm going to do.
So you get there, and known. So all these guys were just playing at different places, like Wolf and Junior and Muddy?
Just in a circle, because mm-hmm. they never did hardly come out and tour like we do today. And
right.
In the South, you would B.B. King, when he came out, you would have Big Joe Turner, the Fire, a lot of doo-wop groups.
Oh, they tour on a bus?
No, everything was in a station wagon then. They wasn't making enough money to get a bus back, because the bus was, I wish you could get the bus at that price today. But everybody was going around in the station wagon, all piled up in the station wagon, because B.B. King told me that he once played 365 days,
but he
never did leave his house. So that wasn't a big, long tour. You
right,
know, you could
right.
play
regional.
10 days in Louisiana, 10 days in Mississippi, which was joining, 10 days in Arkansas, which was joining. So it wasn't a hard job as it is now. We play California. And as soon as I leave here, I got to be in, I think my next one is in Milwaukee.
And you fly, or you're on the bus?
Well, all over, I think mostly all over 4 or 5 I fly, but the bus, I have to make it there, and you have to give the bus a chance to get there.
So when?
But I wasn't always able to do that.
Sure.
So when I first started coming here, I was driving cross country myself in a van with DeLay Junior Wells, and I was the manager. I was the tour guide and everything, man. And still sometimes we didn't make enough money to make it from one gig to nothing. But what kept me going, I'm thinking B.B. King and Mud and them was doing wonders. And they come to me and say, hey, man, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah.
You know, B.B. King told me when I first met him, he said, sometime I just make enough money to make it from one gig to the other.
And what drives you is the love of the music?
The love of music. Wasn't no such thing as love of money then. It's just, you know, right now, when I see people smiling when I'm playing, I say, oh, man, you know, if whatever problem you had, I made you forget it for 5 minutes anyway, you know.
Yeah.
Because music have a tendency to do that, not just blues, all music. When you see people smiling and clapping their hands, I say, if you had a problem, at least I made you forget it for a while.
That's the power of the thing. When I play blues. I listen to a lot of different kinds of music, but there's really nothing more satisfying than playing.
Oh, man, that's the joy of my life.
You're lucky then, because that's what you do.
Well, I try to tell young kids now. I got two sons, wait very late. They at first went into the blues until they got 21 and saw me play. And one of my sons said, oh, my God, I didn't know you could play like that.
How old are you?
I never did go home and say, here's what your daddy did. I just let them make up their own mind.
Yeah.
And as soon as they got 21 years old, they got old enough to come in the club. That's when he said, oh, my God.
Yeah. He saw the whole show.
Oh, yeah.
And your brother played too, yeah?
Yeah, he passed away. I'll be 11 years on the 20th of this month.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You did a few records with him?
Yeah, I played on a couple of his records.
So when you get there and you're in Chicago, you know, how does it start to unfold? I guess, like, you know, I can tell you're playing in the back of anything. Like, I was in a record store just recently, and they were playing some collection. I think it was like Coco Taylor was on it. It was some sort of...
I made our first big record with Wang like Dang Doodle.
Right. And it was a bunch of different artists on this one whole record. And I'm like, that's got to be Buddy Guy. Like, I could hear it. So, I mean, people must be able to identify it. And you can't... You know, that's just something that comes from your heart. So, like, you know, you're insecure about, like, I got to learn something. But other people are like, nobody plays like that guy.
Well, you know, that's what they were telling me. But do you know I didn't realize that?
Yeah, of course.
Until...
Because you had heroes.
Claptons, the Claptons and the Beck and people come say, man, you know, I heard a lick and I had to find out who played it.
Yeah.
And it was you. I'm like saying, I didn't know I played that, man. You know, I just wondered. Matter of fact, when they would call me in for a session behind the Howlin' Wolf Muddy, whoever I played, they would give you like $20 just to make the record.
Yeah.
And I needed the $20. I wasn't even thinking about one day somebody gonna say that's Buddy Guy playing.
Right.
I'm like saying, give me my $20 and I'll put it in there for you, you know?
Yeah. Well, how did that, like, what was it like with those guys? I mean, you get to Chicago and it seems like you made a few singles.
Yeah.
First.
They didn't give me much opportunity to play on my own. They knew I could play, and they said, which I couldn't blame it. The Chess people had made, I mean, the Mudders and Wolf Walters and Sonny Boy had made Chess what they were.
So Cobra Records?
Well, that went there first, because Chess refused
first one,
me.
Right.
And the first somebody who really helped me was the late Otis Rush, which passed away, not quite two years ago.
Otis Rush. Yeah. And he brought you in over there to that smaller label?
Yes, he did. Him and the late Magic Sam.
Oh, Magic Sam.
Yeah.
Oh, that boogie riff that he does.
Yeah,
I'm trying to figure it out.
yeah. Well, you know, that stuff he was doing was Junior Parker out of Texas at first, you know, called Feel Good.
Right, Feel Good.
And then Sam just could wear it out, you know.
Yeah.
Because we used to play all day on Sunday, so from 7 o'clock in the morning and on Monday.
Yeah.
That's when we had all the jobs still here in America. The steel mill was 24/7, so in Chicago you had the steel mill and you had a stockyard there 24/7 with 100,000 people.
Yeah.
And when I went there, I'm like, what the world is this? People playing music at 7 o'clock in the morning and you couldn't get in the club.
Oh, because that was the only day off?
Well, if the shift got off at a certain time in the morning, he don't go away. At night, he's back at work.
Oh, right.
So his time was, let's go party now.
Right.
Because tonight I'll be working when they play in the clubs. And we used to have to play all day on Monday and then Monday night.
Wow.
And I wondered how could you stay up that long? And those guys like Sonny Boy, Muddy Wolf, all of them was young and they were drinking.
Yeah.
I'm like saying, when do you guys get so drunk you can't play?
Yeah.
And they went all day and all night. Man, I've never seen one of them fall down yet.
That's amazing.
I don't know what's like. As a matter of fact, I used to ask them, was they built out of iron?
Yeah. You never drank too much?
No, they taught me how to drink because, you know, when I first went there, I was too shy to sing, and sometimes I feel like that right now.
Yeah.
But they used to call the schoolboy scotch. They said, man, if you drink some of this, you get out of that shyness. And a drink don't cross my mind until I go to the stage. Then they have to give me a little sip or something to say, okay, forget about it. If you play something bad, this little drink of whiskey or cognac will make you forget about it and just do something else to make up for that mistake you made.
Right, and it worked.
Oh, so far it's doing pretty good.
But it never took over your life, which is
good. No, because I got it at my house now. You can come to my house and my housekeeper don't dust my whiskey bottle, which people give it to me. It's got fingerprints on it.
Yeah.
I don't never take a drink at home. Even when I was smoking, I never did smoke when I got to my house.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And just because that was the nighttime shit.
Well, it was the music thing, you know, and right today as I speak to you, I'm still a little shy when I come out on the stage because the public is one of the things that is hard to please all the time.
Yeah.
And sometimes people look at you and say, wait, let me see what this lack. I heard about him, but then when I get the sip, that's when I say, I'm going to see, can I win you tonight?
Yeah. I'll show you.
And sometime I do.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So after you do the stuff at Cobra, so you're hanging around with those guys, with Otis and Magic Sam.
And the late Hal Barraj was just singers.
Yeah.
Betty Everett, she was just a singer.
You know?
And then after the Cobra guy died, that's when Chess came back and found Otis and sent Otis to my house.
Yeah.
And that's when he signed both of us.
And was Ike Turner there?
No, the Cobra record sent down to get Ike because, you know, Ike had a lot to do with BB early success.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yeah.
How so?
I didn't know. He was the one, BB told me, just made some horn arrangement behind him in the early days.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, that was before him and Tina Turner would be.
Sure.
He was just in the house and playing. I heard Tina talking about that, how good. I don't like him, but I just like what he's doing, you know, because he was uptight with that music, man.
He did that, what was it, Rocket 88?
Jacob Brunson.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And he was on that, and then some people think that's the first rock and roll song.
Well, I heard that. I heard that, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I think Ike played piano on it or something.
I don't know what he played, but he was good at it, man, because he was in love with the guitar, and one of the greatest slide guitar players that we all ever heard was Earl Hooker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, oh, man.
Yeah.
And he made some thing with Muddy, because, you know, Muddy was a slide.
Yeah.
Yeah, because me and B's talked the same thing. I tried it, but a slide guitar, you got to be so precise. You know, you can't just jump around on the stage like I like to do.
Right.
Yeah, and move the guitar in different positions. You know, you got to let it be.
Stand still.
You got to be Elmo James and all those people
It's an open tuning, too, I think.
Well, I don't know. Back then, but you know, Derek Trucks and those and Earl Hooker, there wasn't no open tuning.
They play straight,
Oh, yeah, 440.
I've talked to Derek, he's something else, man.
Oh, man, if you hear him play that slide, I'm like saying, that's not a slide you playing, that's your fingers, but it's a slide.
Yeah, he's doing both. It almost sounds like Indian music.
Oh, man, you know, when I first heard that kid, I said, man, what did you do? You know,
he's just born with it.
Yeah, and you know, he still asked me, what was it like playing with Earl Hooker?
Yeah. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What do you tell him?
I don't know, because Hooker was so crazy, man. You know, a lot of the musicians, we just call them crazy because it looked like they was like, I don't care what I do. The first thing Earl Hooker did to me when I first got to Chicago and got to know him was stole that 100-foot card from me, because he figured it was something in the card that made me as crazy as I was. And he was living with his mom.
Yeah.
So I knew I went to work that morning to play on a Blue Monday morning. I couldn't find my card.
Yeah.
And I just went straight to his house, and his mom answered the door. He's asleep. I just busted the door. I said, I'm glad I swung my wire back. And he started like John Lee Hooker a little bit. And I walked in the room and said, I just want to see what you had in it.
Yeah. So you get over to Chess, and you got those guys, Leonard and Phil. What were they like?
They didn't think I had what just before he died. I don't know if you read that or not, but he called me in after the British guys started exploring.
Who, Phil or Leonard?
Leonard.
Yeah.
The British guys started turning those amplifiers up, and you was getting that British sound.
Yeah.
That's when he sent Willie Dixon to my house, said, go get Buddy and bring him down here. So I said, oh, my God, I ain't going to be able to make these little sessions with Mud and Sonny Boy no more because they was calling me in.
You thought you were going to get fired or what?
Well, they wasn't going to use me anymore for some reason. Right. That wasn't just me.
Yeah.
And when I got there, he had on a suit, and I had never been to his office.
Uh-huh.
And he said, come on in the office. I'm saying, well, to myself, you can tell me now. They don't come back down here no more.
Right.
And I think it was, might have been a Cream record he put on for us.
Yeah.
And he said, listen to this.
Yeah.
I'm like saying, what's this? Then he bent over and said, I want you to kick me.
Yeah. Did you?
No, I felt like I should. And he said, because you've been trying to give us this ever since you come here, and we were too dumb to listen.
He said, this is how you were ahead of the game, and they just stuck you with sessions.
Yeah, and then he told me, he said, now you can come in here and do whatever you want.
Wow.
And he didn't live too long after that. I think it was less than a year he passed away.
Well, that's kind of interesting that like it took that full circle stuff. You know, because like, you know, a lot of people say the British guys are the ones that introduced the music to the world in a big way.
Yeah, right.
And the thing was that you were opening that guitar up before them.
Well, they didn't like that. That's what Leonard kept saying. Ain't nobody ready for that wide open noise and that feedback.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a lot of feedback. I just wanted that ring that the British finally went beyond me with it.
Well, right. They were playing the same licks. They were playing your licks and Freddie King's licks.
Right, right.
Because it seemed like at the beginning, you know, Clapton was all Freddie and you, a lot of it, right? And he just cranked that Marshall up, cranked it. Apparently on that first Blues Breakers record, the guy didn't even know how to record him because he refused to turn it down.
Right.
And that was the sound.
Well, you know, Hendrix had and saw me too, and he was in New York, and I was booing him, but he was coming up with the special effects.
Yeah.
And when he got to London, they said, bring it home.
Yeah.
But everybody was saying, wait a minute, nobody want to hear that. You know, this smooth stuff, that Muddy Lightning and all of them is playing is doing very well. So how could you do better than that? But when the British struck it, they said, oh, my God, it is something better than that.
Yeah.
What's it's not better than that, but it's like
the next step.
Well, it's like technology taking us now.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, but also like doesn't it like you know? Because I've been watching some reading about jazz and listening to jazz. That there was a point where you know where you had to straight up jazz, and then those guys went out into space and then changed the whole thing.
Oh yes.
Right. So you know you're going to do that with the guitar too. You got to go to space where you can just do the same old thing.
Well, every time I wake up and turn my radio on, I'm looking for something to say, oh, yeah, something new, you know. But technology has got a lot to do with music right now. And I tell people right now, some of the superstars I will not call names, when you see them doing those big shows on television, it's lip singing. I can't even follow myself on the lip singing, man.
No way.
I tried that.
Yeah.
Because we had disc jockeys before the Chess people died. Yeah. Used to call you in. We'd get a new record out. 45 and they would call you out and they would be spinning the record and they would have the mic on like this and it wasn't on. You was pretending you were singing, but sometimes they would like to click it on and really I said, man, don't turn that on because I can't even follow my own self.
But I imagine like when you're doing all those sessions, like Little Walter was kind of a crazy guy too, right?
Not just Walter, all of them was crazy.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even get into that with a man. You know, choirs that kept... If I was talking to B.B. King like I'm talking to you now, that music would have been gone 20 minutes ago because all the conversation you had with Muddy, Walter Jr., B.B., it always ended up the conversation with something about a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. You start talking off of B.B., what about Let Me Love You or whatever number I wanted to talk about.
Right.
It was always ease back into that woman, buddy. You remember that woman, this woman? This? I said, man, I don't want to hear nothing about no woman. I want to hear something about your career and your playing so I can learn something. Yeah. I can't learn nothing you tell me about a woman.
But you got to watch it. When you were playing with them, you got to watch all those. You got to watch Muddy, right?
And I would used to try to steal in after they found out I could play, and they would never let that happen. If they saw me, it's just like, come on to the stage.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't read music. I'm watching your fingers trying to steal a lick from you.
Right.
With BB or whoever.
Right.
You know? And they would never let me do that.
Who wouldn't? BB or any?
BB or any of them. You know, BB would do his show, but if he would look at me, because I used to would try to hire.
Yeah.
Because I just wanted to hear him. And if he spotted me, he said, "Don't you go nowhere. Come on up here. I want you to play." And I several times, he have took the guitar off and gave it to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want you to steal?
No. He just wanted me to, you know, that's the guy.
Play your own thing.
Man, it was all good. So good. It was like adopted parent.
Yeah.
You know, and they were like saying, "You can play. If somebody don't know you can play, I'm going to let them know you can play right now."
Yeah, right.
And that helped me a lot.
It was like that story about Clapton having Hendrix on.
In England.
And that was the end of it. That was. What about Hubert Sumlin?
He was good.
Right?
Yeah. I heard this record yesterday morning, too. "I Should Have Quit You and Went to Mexico." They had been in the studio 3 days. And Leonard heard this rhythm, and they couldn't get it. And he said, "Call Buddy."
Yeah.
And I got up about 7 o'clock that morning, because that's when they was making the old Leonard and Muddy and them session, was like 6, 7, 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
Because they wanted them to come straight from the bar.
Yeah. Oh, while when they were still hot.
While they were still half drunk. Because half of the time, when you got there, they had the two bottles of whiskey sitting on the keyboard. Wasn't on electric keyboards then. It was the big piano, you know. And they had the whiskey sitting there. "I want you to sound just like you did when you left the club last night." So when they called me, Willie Dixon came and got me, and they said, "Leonard wants you to see, can you hear this rhythm he want?" And I said, I walked in there, and within two cuts, he said, "Now that's what you got. How come y'all can't do that?" And everybody was profane then, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody was an MF.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. When I went in there, I used to be sitting quiet trying to learn, but I still was doing what they asked me, and they said, "Hey, MF."
Yeah.
"Turn your guitar up a little bit. I don't hear enough of you." And I'm like, "I don't know who you're talking to." So I wouldn't look up. They would come out of the engineer room and punch me on my shoulder and say, "I'm talking to you, MF." I said, "Oh, okay." 6 weeks when I was there, when they say, "Hey, MF," I say, "What?"
Yeah. And what was the groove they were looking for? Was it Hubert groove?
No, it was something that Leonard could hum it to you, and I could hear what he was doing. It was like, boom, 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 boom.
Killing Floor?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that riff.
Yeah. As soon as I heard it, I said, "Yeah, this goes, that's how I let the tape roll."
And yeah. So you start recording on Chess, and then, you know, how does Delmark come into it? You were doing both? You were recording with Junior on Delmark and then your own stuff on Chess?
No, well, you know, they were so slick then, they didn't want you to record for nobody else. And if you notice that album, what you're talking about, my name
right,
on it.
Right, I know.
It's called Friendly Chap.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that was me, they call a friendly chap. That's that shit, Leonard know that was me playing on that.
You were trying to hide it from Leonard?
No, you had to hide it from them because they had a little contract on you, you know, and that if they said you can't play for nobody but us, which they had all the rights. It's like baseball contracts. They done changed it now. They can get rid of you, but you can't get rid of them.
Of course, yeah. And that album's all you. It's all you and Junior.
Yeah, uh-huh. It was that early in the morning. I didn't know that Delmark Records. It was a record shop. And he just decided to catch us that morning and have me and Junior record something.
That's Bob Coaster?
Bob Coster.
Somebody
just told me he just sold it, though. He don't own it no more because somebody's chasing my son now. The one I told you about didn't know who I was until he was 21. And they're trying to get him to cut something with it.
Yeah, it was I think they sold it recently. But back in the day, it was like on Grand Avenue or something.
I forget where it was, but I think he moved once or twice since that Hoodoo Man album.
Well, you know what's interesting about that record? It's so clean, you know? I mean, it's just so clean.
Well, you know, it was just the straight things then. And you didn't have all the tech you got now. It was real to real. We used to make a record, and if they heard a beat in there that they didn't like or liked, they would have to take a razor blade and cut that little piece out of the tape. Now they punch a button, and it'll cut it out.
Oh, okay, yeah. Or they can add it somewhere else.
Uh-huh. And because, you know, during the session back in those days, you would take a break, and they'd be playing something and see, do they need to play it again? You could tell as yourself. Sometime I'd be in the studio now, and I could use the bathroom and come back and say, "All right, we're ready to go again. Who's that?" "Oh, that's you. That's you." That's what you just did. You know, that's just how much technology and got into evolving into music and whatever else you do now with tech.
You kind of mix it up, you know, because like on that record and on the, some of the earlier Chess records, the sound was like, you know, straight Strat sound. It was real clean.
Yeah. And you can't hardly get that no more.
Very few people play like that. Robert Cray played like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There's something about that, you know, that in-between position that pops a little bit.
I know. And that's what those British guys were giving me credit for, because without them, I don't know if I'd be talking to you now, because I was like a unknown. I was there, but I was unknown. And all of a sudden, they start saying, we got to find out who Buddy Guy is.
You know, because you used to bend those notes out there.
Oh, yeah.
And ride the edge, and they're like, what's that sound?
Oh, yeah.
When did you start real, you know, using effects or a wah pedal or crank it up?
I don't hardly use that now. You know, the only time I use it when I want to let the people know about the late Jimi Hendrix or somebody like that.
Right.
I just try to do each night on my show.
Yeah.
I just don't go in the dark. I just let people know who John Lee Hooker was, who I hit a matter of fact, I go to the stage night for last. And I would ask the audience, there was a lot of people up there in California, and I said, I don't have to be right, but I want y'all to know, and y'all give me some names, who you think was the best guitar player. And then I'm going to give you my opinion, and I don't have to be right. And they started calling you. I said, no, I'm talking about before me. How about Stevie Ray? I'm talking about before Stevie Ray. How about, and they just name and all. I said, now hold it, let me give you my opinion. And I hit a note by B.B. King. And
boom.
Boom.
Yeah. And John Lee, that guy, like he had his whole own groove.
Oh, yeah.
You had, I listened to that, it's a weird record, that Hooker and Heat record with Can Heat.
Yeah.
And they're all trying to follow him.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because you know we were the best of friends, before he died. And day one when I met him, I never did meet him yet. The first time I met that guy, him and Big Mama Thorne was in Germany.
Yeah.
And
doing that weird show that they put on TV?
I think it might have been that, but I didn't know who he was, and he didn't know who I was. So everybody was still drinking heavy then.
Yeah.
So my thing was, I came downstairs a little earlier than what me and you talking now, and I said, I just got to meet John Lee Hooker, because that's the first thing I taught myself how to play was Boogie Chillin'.
Yeah.
So I walked down to this big table in the morning. It was like a big dinner table. It was eating breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was just talking. And Big Mama was a big wise. You know, she had the flow. And I'm I just went over in the corner and picked up acoustic guitar like that and started playing Boogie Chillin'.
Yeah.
And a guy came over to me and said, who's you? And I'm like saying, I don't want to be bothered with you. You can't talk. So I'm trying to get John Lee's attention. And he kept messing with me so much. I said, my name is Buddy. I'm just on the show. I'm trying to meet John Lee Hooker. And he just fell out on his knees and tears started coming out of his eyes. And he didn't say he was John Lee. He said, I'm Johnny. I said, I don't want to meet Johnny. I said, I want to meet John Lee Hooker. And until his death, he laughed about that.
You didn't even know it was him.
No, because I didn't know you could sing like that and don't stutter as you sing it. And after I got to know him as a good friend, when he was trying to tell me something like we talking now, I said, man, don't tell me, sing it.
Did he? Would he?
And then he would outlaugh me because some people would get offended by that. Right. He never did.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, there's some, like, he's one of those guys where it's like he invented something.
Oh, well, and then he used to show me his hand. Standing at the hotel. And I don't know how in the world he saw these calluses on my hand. And he was the elder guy, and this was yesterday. And he says, how long have you been playing guitar? And I looked around at him, I'm like saying, now who are you asking me this question? So my manager was there, and the point I'm trying to get to, John Lee Hooker didn't have no callus. And he looked at me once and said, to feel my hand is softer than a woman.
Yeah.
I said, well, how do you play the guitar? Because he just slapped his guitar and just played that book of children, man. Yeah. You ain't never heard him squeezing no strings or nothing like that. And he would joke, man. And I can tell you another joke on. We was playing in Canada at a blues festival. And it was on the island. And it was light raining. Mm. So he hadn't played before me, and I'm finna catch the ferry and go out there. So I met him. I said, I'm glad I met you, man. I said, now you can tell me what I do if I play boogie or just play some slow blues or whatever they're playing out there. Let me know what to do. And he looked at me and said, I don't know. I just hit my guitar and said, now give me my money. Oh, man, I miss that, you know. I really do, man. You know, they don't make them like that no more.
Yeah.
I don't think there will never be a B.B., Muddy, Wolf Walter, and John Lee now. They could make you forget about if the promoter didn't pay you. They can make you feel like you got paid.
Because
you had to laugh at them, whatever they were doing. Oh, yeah.
And also, just the idea, I don't know what it was really, but it seems like a lot of players now, and just in general, that they don't they can't get to themselves. You know what I mean? They get to somebody else, you know, and the style is the style. But, you know, it seems like you guys and the generation before you, they couldn't help but be themselves.
Right, right.
And I don't know what that is, but it's
I don't
great.
Know. I tried to figure it out. Me and BB and all of them used to talk when it was in their good health. We just never could figure out what that is. But, you know, I used to look at them, and I thought when I went into Chicago, I'm like saying, all I want to see these beautiful homes or beautiful cars or whatever they got. And I remember very well one Monday morning, there was a harmonica player named Shaky Harden, James Cotton, Junior Wells, and I forget who else, a couple more harmonica players. And I looked, and there was little Walter in the corner. And I looked, and I said, let me start some crap here. I said, hey, man, they want to know why you here, because they're going to blow you out of here today.
Yeah.
And guess what he said to me? He said, hey, man, go buy me a half pint of gin. Let me separate the men from the boys. Now, this is little Walter.
Yeah.
And I said, me buy you a half a pint of gin? And a half a pint of gin back then in 1958 was 98 cents.
Yeah.
And I had about $2. I said, you can have both of them.
Yeah.
And I went to the stage and cranked up. And it was coming up one by one. And when little Walter came up, he started playing something. And I looked at Junior Wells. I said, man, did you hear that? He said, yeah. I said, what did he do? He said, well, you know he plays this harmonica bottom side up. So I said, oh, y'all should turn him bottom side up.
He played it the other way?
Yeah, yeah. He didn't play it straight like the rest of the guys.
And it seemed like he was playing almost like, it sounds like, you know, he took a lot from the sax players. Like he
I don't know what he did, but he had that tone, man. Because I told my son a week ago, I said, just listen at him closely, because there's something about what he was doing. And he never did how to show the harmonica.
Right.
Most of the harmonica players, Junior would turn it loose. Sonny Boy used to turn it loose and put it in his mouth like this and don't hold it.
Right, right.
I even seen him take it and put it on his goozer pipe right here.
Yeah.
And you could hear him.
Sonny Boy?
Sonny Boy.
Well, he is a showman too,
uh-huh.
right?
He could put that harmonica back in his mouth just like a cigar.
Yeah.
And blow like this microphone and hit the notes right with it. And I'm like, man.
Yeah.
But that Walter had something. He would hide that harmonica in both hands.
And play right up on the mic, too.
Right. And every once in a while, he would open that hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something when he opened that hand, you heard that you didn't when he closed. And I used to tell harmonica players, I said, watch that, man.
That's the tone.
Well, that's what I saw BB in. I said to myself, BB had a rhythm in that left hand.
Yeah.
He didn't need a special effect.
Right.
Because he could vibrate that man on the pinky finger. He could vibrate that better than I can with him, the rest of the fingers I got.
Yeah.
And I know 1,000 guitar players looked at me and said, you right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's that unique gift.
It's something you have that God gave you that he didn't give nobody else.
What was Wolf's It was that voice?
It's just his voice.
Yeah.
You know, because first he was just a high harmonica player. And then for the end of his life, he was playing guitar too.
Yeah.
A lot of people saw that guitar jump out front. After Leo and Les Paul and them amplified it,
yeah,
a lot of people was saying, I need to go to the guitar because the guitar players is going...
Yeah,
are getting paid a little more than the harmonica players.
Oh,
or whatever.
Right. Once he electrified it, and it, you know, mm-hmm. and then it became. Mm-hmm. That's the thing people want to see.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now, when the new guys started coming around, like were you around then when Butterfield, and Bloomfield,
all of them was coming up in Chicago.
Yeah.
I can make you laugh about that. You know, when they first started coming up in Chicago to play the blues. The blues clubs then was 99.9 black people playing blues. When you saw a white face come into a blues club, you say, that's a cop. And we couldn't afford to buy the drinks, so we was buying the stinking wine and stuff, and you would hide it because you had to bring it in under your coat or something and hide it. And so you would look and see a white face and say, don't pull up that bottle of wine because they're going to take it and pour it out.
Yeah.
So that's a cop sitting over that table. And this is Michael Bloomfield, Charlie Musselwhite, and all these guys. Eric Clapton and them start coming in, and all of a sudden you get to know them, and now you can tell them what they was doing. I, man, you making me miss drinking my wine. And they were just cracking up, man. I thought you was a policeman, man. I said, no, man, we come here to listen to the blues.
So they were learning, they were watching.
Uh-huh, Michael Bloomfield and them, and I used to see him. Every time I saw a white face, if he wasn't a cop with a uniform on, I'd say he's a detective.
He was an interesting player, huh?
Oh, man. You know, his dad was a doctor.
Oh, really?
And I found out that his dad didn't want him to play the stuff he was doing because he wanted him to, I guess, kind of follow his footsteps, because a doctor back then, you know, you got a chance to make a decent living as a doctor, not as a musician.
Yeah, sure.
But I guess his dad didn't know sooner or later music would make more than a doctor if you were lucky enough and good enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Butterfield, I think he learned a lot from Walter, huh?
Well, he could play, man. You know, let's just face it. And then when he left Chicago and come out to California, I think he got hooked in the... Well, back in the 60s, all of them was into a little draw. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It killed a lot of them.
I look at it like this. We ain't going to live always. You know, I looks at them, and they used to try to introduce me to them for something. I just never like it. You know, I ain't never tried the cocaine. The Grateful Dead made me draw for a reefer in Berkeley, California one night.
Yeah.
And he walked me around behind the little blues club. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I drawed off that thing, and he said, now you're going to play some stuff you never heard. And I said, okay. And I got in the club. Eric Clapton was sitting out there. And the next day he called me and said, man, you play some stuff you never heard. I said, you're right. I didn't hear nothing.
How'd you get involved with that? I saw you in that movie about that bus, about that Festival Express bus.
Well, that was
the guys from the band and everybody.
That was Janis and the Grateful Dead and all that. That was that guy in Canada, almost like Sears Roebuck, Eden and Walt.
Uh-huh.
They would rent that train in Montreal.
Oh, it's a train, right, yeah.
And it would run all the way across the country. Yeah. But we never didn't make it to Vancouver.
No.
They had them tow the train up and drank all the whiskey and smoked all the dope by the time we got to Winnipeg.
And that was it?
That was it. Yeah, because it was jumping on top of the train, man. It was. If I had to do it, I'd do it all over again.
Well, there's that footage of you with that 100-foot wire.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because they had me. That's why, you know, Mick Jagger finally got it, because they had me on a tractor there once, and they lift me up in there on the tractor.
Yeah, right on the cherry picker thing.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, that's where Mick got it, huh?
Well, I seen him on do that, and he had a safety belt on him with a chain. But I didn't have nothing on me on that one, you know.
You just had the guitar. You were focused.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's when my youngest brother had just come and joined me, man. And he didn't live, you know, he lived on the 20th this month. He'd been gone 11 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I noticed that it's interesting because, you know, you talk about, you know, getting the respect that you deserve. It seems like it took a while. But, like, there was a period there. Did you not make records for a decade?
Well,
like from 80 to 90?
It was somewhere in there that I went to a guy come from England with a record company called GSP.
Yeah.
and the late Willie Dixon was living, and I didn't want to get, I had learned my lesson from how the record company was ripping off all the, not yeah. just blues, the jazz and everybody else, because none of the, you know, none of those guys had as much education as I got. And I don't have a high school education, but I sit back and tried to learn from what I seen was happening to them.
Yeah.
And I stayed blank there until, I think it was JSP I did one, then Vanguard came and got me.
Yeah.
In the 60s, that's when the things come right after Delmont record.
Yeah.
And I stayed with Vanguard, it must have been about, was it one or two albums?
Yeah.
Because one of them was live in Berkeley, I did that. And I forget the other one. Then they had they made me and Junior do one with a jazz piano player named Junior Mance.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And all that went on and went on. And finally, what was that, in 1989, Eric yeah. Clapton had invited me to the Royal Albert Hall. And that's when a guy come up to me in Royal Albert Hall and say, I want to sign you. And he was British, and I didn't know the record company was in America, because all Americans used to, how old is Buddy Guy? 99
yeah.
years old? And they would say, I don't give up on him.
Yeah.
And the first thing I did was went to England and made, and I wrote the damn right I got the blues, and that's when they come back and find out the label was here.
Yeah.
In New York, and they say, I said, well, man, I thought it was a British label, but it's a British guy.
Yeah.
Who signed me, because the British would listen to us more than Americans would, so far right. as what we had to offer.
Right, and then I couldn't even find that record, the one that's DJ Play My Blues.
Yeah,
yeah. Was that like sort of like that was a? Was
I
that,
think that's I think that is that. I'm not sure on that, but I think that might have been the JSP. I might have did that because that's when he came in, and he was a ripoff too. Because I'm trying to, we got an attorney in New York, and I'm trying to chase him down. I went to his house 30 years ago in London.
Yeah.
And he said, I owe you some money, but I ain't checked my books yet. And the record was 20 years old then. I say, when do you check your books?
Yeah, but it just seemed like there was a lot of time between them. And then Damn Right I Got the Blues, that's the one that blew up.
Blew up. That's what took me to my first Grammy.
And that was like, you know, how old are you at that point?
Oh, that was 1989 or something like that.
That was that guy, John Porter?
John Porter.
Because you did a few records with him.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it's and I don't know how much anything influences it, because I was looking at his credits, you know, he was, you know, kind of a new wave kind of, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and then you get a couple of guys like that you work with that shows, I don't know how the relationship works, but it does change the sound, doesn't it? When you have a producer, how closely do you work with those guys? You just let them do it.
Well, you know, like I said earlier, I like to listen.
Yeah.
And I like to listen to you or whoever else can come in and may give me an idea. And it's like, if you know you drank too much but you need somebody else to tell you, you don't need nobody else to tell you. You already know that. But when they tell you, you say, oh, yeah, you're right. You know?
You're right.
So that's what I was looking at with that. So
that's how it works, huh?
Uh-huh.
Because you did a few albums with him, and then, you know, and then I guess, like, it must have changed your whole business, the touring, everything, the Grammy, record sales.
Well, you know, the Grammys and the record sales helps anybody if you can do it, you know. And right now, today, like I said, I talked to B.B. early, Mudd and them before they passed away. Blues, and I heard George Benson doing a kind of hardcore blues lately, and I'm like saying blues must be ain't quite dead yet, because you used to, you know, it used to be so good listening when you just turn on an AM station. Before all the big FM stations came in, you could hear Mahalia Jackson.
Yeah,
you could hear Lightning Hopkins, and then you could hear Lou Rawls. I mean, they played everything.
Mm-hmm.
And now you turn on a radio station, and disc jockeys, I was telling my manager coming in here yesterday, some of the disc jockeys used to talk for you.
Yeah.
Just like if B.B. King would hit a good note, and you'd hear the disc jockey cut right in and say, come on, B.B. And this used to get me, you know, and it was a good feeling for them to say that. Look out, B.B., you know, look out, Howlin' Wolf, you know, look out, Big Joe Turner, you know. And those little things like that was getting next to me, and that would make me jump and say, whatever they did, they made the disc jockey recognize it.
Yeah.
And that's the good stuff don't happen on that highway anymore.
No, and I think also the blues was like one of those things where there was a certain point, it seemed, where everybody just tried to play it. Like you know, every bar band, everybody in the world that they could do it. But and then I think sometimes it's good that the music's getting out there, but then the public gets a sense that, well, that's just a blues and anybody can play it. And then they forget about the guys that really play it.
Right.
Because they always stand out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but like I can pick up that guitar and play some blues, but, you know, who cares?
Well,
I mean, I like it, but, you know, but the dudes that really, you know, that stand out, they stand out.
Yeah, it's almost like my mom used to tell me, you know, a ladder is easy to climb. But she said, if you let one foot slip, your butt is easy to hit the ground.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the way blues is, man. It don't, you know, you luck as the devil in the world if you can hit a record. And this was happening back then in the late 50s and 60s. You could get one, I remember some blues players had one hit record and it just bloomed. Never had another one.
Right.
And I don't know how that worked, but I'm like saying they had a guy called High Heel Sneakers, Tommy Tucker. Leonard Chestnut was going crazy. And I think he made one or two more, but it never did get big as that first one, High Heel Sneakers.
Well, that's the weird thing about hits. Sometimes they'll kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And a lot of, I guess it seems like what you were saying before is that Chess and those guys at the time, it took them a minute to come around to real blues, and they were trying to do soul, right? And they were trying to do R&B music. And,
well, they had the jazz, too. You know, when they got going, they had the Gene Ammons and all the big jazz guys there, man. But they never did let you step in the way of Muddy and Wolf and Walter, because that's who opened them up.
Yeah.
And they was taking on, because they was like, it was so bad once that you could go there and open a little label. And if it take off, if it took off, Leonard Chess would come in and say, "I'll buy that."
Yeah,
and he'd offer you a little money and buy the whole little label from you, and he would take it over
just to get the artists.
Well, at first he hadn't turned you down, but he didn't know you could do that. I remember a guy named Bobby Saxon made a record called "I'm Trying to Make a Living," and a black guy would come down on 47th Street and say, "This is my record company," and put that out on. You could just let one radio station or two radio stations play, and if it took off, Leonard found that out. He was coming find you. Man, I want that record, man. You know, I'd buy
really?
It. Oh, yeah.
But he didn't have mob connections or nothing, did he?
I don't know about the mob connection, because someone told me even the Cobra record had some connection with that, but I never did get that deep to find out whether it was or not. But I do know that Duke Records out of Houston, Chess, and all of them had some connection. Like if I screwed up with Chess, they called it a black ball. So Duke didn't want me. Of course, back then, RCA and those labels, like I'm with now, they didn't think about no blues.
Right.
Because you know? I'm with RCA now, and that was a hand-me-down. I bought this label. But because this label was the one who signed me in 89 after Eric Clapton's show.
Yeah.
And then I think they might have went out of business. And next thing I know, say, you know, you with RCA. I said, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because they bought it. Oh, what was that show that Eric did? Like 23 guitar? It was a big guitar show?
No, it was the Royal Albert Hall. He did it for, I don't know if it was every year, but every year it was a big thing. He was, because he was, I think he might have been the only blues guy that was going and was selling that thing out.
You look at him as the guy that turned it around for you a little bit?
Yeah, because he brought me in there, and when he brought me in there, that's when I got signed by the bigger label.
It's amazing, the lack of respect sometimes, because I read years ago, I think I read a Muddy biography that said that Chess had him painting the place sometimes early on.
I didn't ever see that.
Yeah,
because I was in Chess' studio doing a record called My Time After Why, and the Stones come in there to do an audition, and they line up in the wall with mine was this size, why they would lock me up to sing, but I could look out the window and see the rest of the band.
Yeah.
And I look, and these guys, they stood them against the wall. Mick Jagger. And Bill.
Charlie.
Yeah. And I'm finna get angry.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they say, that's a Rolling Stone, which was nothing to think about then, just a Rolling Stone. So Muddy Waters that helped them brought the instruments upstairs so they could do the little audition for Chess. Now, that's the most, because I think they got some clips of paper on that now.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, in Chicago. I had it, but You know, when I get something like that, if some people get a chance, I'll never see it again because they'll take that.
That was the first time the Stones came to Chicago and they were watching everybody?
Yeah.
Did you meet Hendrix?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Do you know the first night I met him, I was in New York and I was had that wide, long wire, and I was putting on this show, man, and I had the guitar, I think, behind my back.
Yeah.
And somebody was coming, and we got a clip on that, too, at my club. I think they still got it, and then the reel tape.
Oh, really?
And he was coming, plugging this tape up, reeling the reel, and all I heard was, that's Jimi Hendrix, that's Jimi Hendrix. But I said, so what? Who is Jimi Hendrix, you know? And he laughed about it before he passed. He said, man, I've been trying to want to see you all my life. I canceled a gig to make sure I catch you tonight. He had a gig that night, and he canceled it so he could come see me play in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice guy.
Yeah, he was in, all of them was into their thing then. Yeah. You know, we never did, like I told you earlier about Muddy and BB and them, about the women. We never did talk about nothing, but it was the music.
Yeah.
And then half of the time, he was feeling pretty good. So we didn't ever have one of those conversations, but Jimmy, and then I knew his dad very well, and you know, his sister still do the Hendrix Experience shows. Yeah. So we got two of them to do later on this year.
And all these guys seem to come and pay their respect now. I mean, you play with, you know, Derek and Keith and Eric Jeff Beck a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And Billy Gibbons on a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And what do you think of Gary Clark? I've talked to him.
Oh, he's a good guy, man. You know,
nice guy.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, you know, what was that about 5 or 6 years ago? I was playing a concert in New York, and he was sitting there. I said, well, man, come on up here and play, you know. I don't know if you heard the one, Quinn Sullivan. I found him. He was 7 years old, man, and he was playing them Hendrix licks like that at seven.
Wow.
You got to check him out.
Quinn Sullivan.
Uh-huh.
He's great.
Just check him out, and if you can pull him up, he was seven.
Yeah.
And I'll call the kid up a little, you know, if the little girl boy, and sometimes he'll hit one or two notes, and I say, thank you. When he came up, I couldn't get rid of him, man, because he was playing like Hendrix. He was playing BB. He was playing me. He was playing everybody. I'm like,
what is that?
I don't know. This is something you can't teach.
No, I know. But there's a few of them around. Derek's that way, too. They're just these prodigies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can't teach that what they got. You know, you can learn. But when you catch them that young already playing like that, that's just some God-gifted talent.
So yeah, it's like magic.
Oh,
and you play with Kim Wilson, too, on the harp.
Oh, a lot of time. You know, when I first started going to Texas, I was back to the old conversation. When I'm from Louisiana, we used to could pick up some of the radio stations coming out of Texas and all country and western. Eddie Arnold and people like that. Yeah. The horseback wrestling movies with the acoustic guitar. Yep. And when I first went down in Austin, Texas, and I'm like saying, now, who's this, including Stevie Ray Vaughan?
Yep.
And I'm playing the blues, and a guy on the club, Clifford Anton, passed away. He's a white guy, and he was just sitting there smiling because he knew I'm like,
what?
Blues being white by playing by a white man in Texas?
Yeah.
What is this? And B.B., you got to hear B.B. King sing about Johnny Winters. He said, he was down there, they called Johnny up. He said, no, this is not a white guy playing like this.
Yeah.
Especially the blues, you know.
Yeah, and Jimmy's good too, Jimmy Vaughn.
Oh, Jimmy's on the show with me tomorrow.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, yeah.
I've talked to Jimmy. He's great.
Oh, man, yeah. Him and his little family, man. You know, his wife, he got two daughters, teenagers now. And I think I introduced him to his wife he got now.
Oh, wow. Well, I'll tell you, man, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Real honor. And, you know, and are you back in the studio soon, or what are you going to do?
Well, I think they got me coming in November, and, you know, I'm always surprised when the record comes, like RCA said, can we get him back in there? I say, yo, I must have broke even. The blues record must have made y'all feel like you didn't lose nothing on me, because I'll be looking for that red pink slip every time I finished the album, and it's time for another one. I'm waiting to say, well, he's not doing well, so we can't record you no more. But they done asked for it, I think, like 3 or 4 or 5 months ago. When can we get him back in the studio? So we planned it, I think, sometime in November.
Who's your favorite guy, other than your own songs? Whose songs you like playing the best? Because you play a lot of people's songs.
I like Muddy. Yeah. You know, I like Muddy and BB. That's not a night pass. I won't hit that lake, and that's not very few nights I won't just say, here's a Jimi Hendrix. And then I will get up there and say, now, I got to thank the British, because here's what they were playing and brought it back to you because you didn't know who Muddy Waters was until the Rolling Stones came in on a television show called Shindig.
Yeah.
And they was trying to get the Stones to do it, and Mick Jagger said, I'll do it if you let me bring Muddy Waters. And white America said, who in the hell is that?
Yeah.
And he said, you mean to tell me you don't know who Muddy Waters is? And we named ourselves after his famous record, Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
And some people like said, what? You know, and it's true.
Yeah.
Because that's what they named themselves out of.
That's right.
Rolling Stone. Yeah.
Well, now I want to come. Are there tickets?
Oh, we get you one. Talk to the manager when we get out here.
I'm excited. All right, buddy. Thanks,
you got
man.
It.
Buddy Guy. Love it. Love the stories. Really great to talk to him. Currently on tour around the country. You can get all his tour dates at buddyguy.net. The most recent album is The Blues Is Alive and Well, but go back and listen to some of that Chess stuff. Listen to some of his early stuff. Now I'm going to play my Stratocaster through an Echo Box.
Boomer lives.